Maybe my home's on the road. The road's the only place I feel home. I don't know if I'm ever gonna get back again this way. The road's the only place I feel. Hello and welcome to the My Home is on the Road show. This is the half-hour weekly show for people that believe that home is where you park it. On this week's show, we're going to hear the story of Nickel, at least the first part of it. Nickel traveled with me on a summer tour 5 years ago. When we started our journey together, we were both lost souls in our own very different ways, and we hardly knew each other. We just trusted our instincts and set off together on the road for a month. Next week, I'll tell you the rest of the story of how we found each other again 5 years later on a dance floor 2,000 miles from her home. So now, part one of the story of Nickel paying me back. This week, on the road, Nickel paid me back. It was a debt I never expected to be repaid. I guess it wasn't a debt, really. I told her I gave their money as a gift, when I gave it to her, 5 years ago. It was right after the biggest heartbreak of my life. I fell for Rachel very hard. We met the night I opened for Dan Byrne in Anchorage. She was in the crowd. She was beautiful, long, wavy black hair that fell in ever-mysterious ways over her shoulders and down her back. Deep hazel eyes and a sensuous body. She'd just gotten to Alaska and had listened to Dan Byrne's Alaska Highway album on the way up that long road from the lower 48. We danced that night, talked a bit. That fall we fell in love, hard in love. My friends had never seen me like that, like light just shone out through my eyes, like my heart glowed every day. But inside I was scared, scared it would all go away. She was a vivacious girl from a rough childhood, scrappy, hot, flirtatious, but with a somehow unstable heart. I could tell somehow, my intuition told me. The way she fell for me so quickly, the way I meant so much to her, filled such a big hole in her heart, somehow I knew it could all come crashing to an end quickly, at any time. My wise friend Gary told me one night over at Timmy's back porch, "Dave, sometimes the hottest flames burn out the quickest." Thus, I was warned. When it happened, it was over a payphone in Atland, British Columbia. After 9 months together, I left for 2 months on the road, playing music like I did every summer. Things weren't perfect in our relationship when I left, but we'd agreed to make it through the separation. She was going to fly to Seattle and travel with me for a week in the middle of it. It would be 4 weeks apart, one together and then three more apart. We could make it. I set off on the road. The band came with me for the first 2 weeks and 1,500 miles. 5 days into the trip, we were in Atland, ready to be the closing act of the Atland Music Festival. Atland is an old gold rush town, 60 miles down a dirt road from the Yukon Territory. A quaint town on a gorgeous lake, rimmed with mountains, the source of the mighty Yukon River. 10 miles past the town was the Warm Springs, where Backwoods Benny lived. He was the visionary that started this highly successful music festival in this remote location. The town had only two payphones. "Don't put your quarter in until your party answers," was the mantra, sometimes even announced from the main stage. On a little pole outside the general store, the red Pac-Man-shaped payphone unit sat beneath a streetlight. That's the one she dumped me on. I was devastated. Devastated. I couldn't eat, I couldn't sleep, I drank whiskey and clung to the camaraderie of the band. Neighbor Timmy was the drummer. He knew both Rochelle and me, knew how much we were in love. One morning, I walked around the Eden of Backwoods Benny's Warm Spring homestead, unable to sleep. Timmy couldn't sleep either. He'd been trying at it, reclined in the front seat of his Subaru wagon, but his back popped with pain and he was out walking too. We talked. The pine trees and the wildflowers moved gently in the quiet early morning breeze. All the others were still asleep. That's where the grief swept over me. The swaying branches blurred as the tears welled up, and soon I couldn't see at all. Soon I couldn't stand. Timmy held me up. The short, Short but steady, divorcee, father, survivor of a massive car wreck a few years back. He held me up, as I wept uncontrollably. I don't know how long. Long. I wept and wept. He never let go. I'll never forget that. Weeks later, determined to move on, I called Nickel. Nickel was a petite firecracker of a girl I met briefly in a gig in Prince George, British Columbia last summer. I told her I would call her when I came back through town, and now I was. It was a beautiful summer evening when I rolled into Prince George, PG as the locals call it. The directions I'd scrawled on the back of an envelope led me to her apartment. She'd been in the woods nearby gathering wild herbs. When I got there, she made us tea with what she'd gathered. We talked the night away. I stayed that night on a mattress in her basement. We talked about a lot of things and decided on one. Between jobs and with her son leaving soon to live with his dad for 2 months, she should travel with me this summer. I continued south to play my gigs in Chehalis, Washington. 5 days later, and after 48 hours on a Greyhound bus, she squinted in the early morning sun outside Vancouver, British Columbia. A fistful of wildflowers I had picked in my hand, I was there to greet her. The first day, driving south through coastal Washington, was a foggy dream of a sunshiny summer day. We were both sleep-deprived. We were both unsure who the other one really was. We'd only gotten to know each other, really, that one night, over wild herb tea. One thing was for sure. We were beginning our journey, a journey that would deeply change both of us. We would never be the same again. We stopped early for the night on a dead-end dirt road in the forest. We found things to wear for pajamas, unsure yet if we were friends or lovers. Friends, so far. We cuddled up, and we slept well. We fell into the rhythm of the road well together, streaming south towards Nevada City, California. In the starry dark of a desolate scrub desert northeast California, we drove in silence, oldies radio murmuring from some little town radio station. Then the first few bars of the Platters' Twilight Time strained from the speaker. Ever since I fell in love with the Platters' smooth, haunting ballads when I was in the 8th grade, ever since then I'd always had a romantic dream, a dream of gently slow dancing in the headlight beams of a parked car to that song. I stopped the bus on a deserted gravel driveway. Nickel looked at me. I asked her if she would dance. And that long-ago teenage dream finally came true. Under that canopy of high desert stars, we became lovers that night. Nickel, the single mom between jobs but holding it together, had never crossed the border into America. Me, the romantic dreamer with a freshly broken heart, knew instinctively that this trip was meant to be. We had to find a way to make it happen. Nickel scraped together the money for the bus fare, and shortly after she got off the Greyhound in Vancouver, I gave her $300. It was a gift, I explained. The job I worked 9 months of the year paid well. And what was money for if not to give us the freedom to make good things happen? I didn't want her to be beholden to me, asking for a few bucks here and there for an ice cream cone or a souvenir. I gave her the money so I wouldn't have to worry about money. We could be two people sharing an adventure. I gave her the money so we could concentrate on that. This week, 5 years later, Nickel paid me back. Then there was the White Cat. The White Cat traveled with us on our adventure. The White Cat belonged to my ex-girlfriend from 2 years previous. Her name was Stacy, the girlfriend, that is. And in the years since we broke up, she had fallen in love with a Coast Guard guy, a coastie, as they call him in Alaska. A few months before, they'd moved to Hawaii. But because of the myriad of animal quarantine laws in the Aloha state, the White Cat had to wait stateside for a few more months. So the White Cat came with me that summer on my tour. Over the years, the White Cat's name evolved from Squeakers to Squeaks to Squeakies to Squeeze and now to Squeezy, or of course, the White Cat. It didn't matter what you called her anyway. The White Cat was deaf. And she wasn't the brightest bulb in the chandelier either. She was the result of inbreeding in someone's vain attempt to get a pure white cat with blue eyes, which they did, but like almost all pure white cats with blue eyes, she was deaf. She was a mangy, flea-ridden, drowned lab rat of a kitten when Stacy rescued her from the side of the highway. When she didn't come to the kitchen to the sound of cat food, when she was often startled from sleep by a touch, Stacy began to realize she was deaf. and I think her deafness was one big reason she didn't mind traveling in the bus. Quite liked it most days, actually. Traveling with a deaf, dumb cat takes a certain adaptation. I kept a shoebox-sized metal pan in the front as a litter box. I didn't buy litter. I found it. I found it everywhere. And Squeezy used it all of it. Some days. Some days it was sand. Some days it was dirt. Some days it was wood chips. Even pea gravel one time from the side of the road where there's nothing better to be found. The gravel startled me awake one night as she clanked it with a terrible crunch in the metal pan. Not that other cats come when you call them, but a deaf cat certainly wouldn't. So she wore a harness and a leash whenever she was outside. And I made it a point to always tie her to a rock or a bush, and a hard and fast rule to never tie her to the bus, lest one tragic day I forget Squeezy tied to the bumper when I drive off. Squeezy loved the gentle bouncing of the bus on the northern highways, and she'd often perch in the blankets folded in the back window and stare at the perplexed drivers perpetually tailing behind me in my slow-moving VW bus. So it was. Squeezy was with us as we snaked away through the Sierras of Northern California. But she wasn't with us that one morning near Lake Tahoe. She wasn't in the bed with us, anyway. But that wasn't unusual. She often curled herself in the front seat or under the bed, but this morning she wasn't. Not there, not under the blankets, not anywhere. Searching the front seat, I found the conundrum. I'd left the front window open all night. She must have slowly let her curiosity lean her further and further out until she plopped down on the ground. I'm sure she looked back at the open window now, high above her, too far for her to jump back in. Squeezy's fierce ignorance seemed to always miraculously keep her out of danger, but having just been warned about mountain lions in the area the very night before, I was scared. No use calling her, of course. I searched. Nickel searched. Periodically, cars roared by on the highway not 50 feet away. My thoughts cast back to how she often lay on the warm asphalt of the highway late at night. I often rescued her from that troublesome predicament. I'd roll her back and forth on the trafficless highway. Squeezy playin' roadkill again, I'd tease her, as the chubby belly flopped skyward. Squeezy playin' roadkill. But now she was gone. Now she might be roadkill. How could I have been so stupid, so irresponsible? She's probably been out most of the night. I searched the highway. No sign of her. No blood-splattered spat on the pavement. Thank God. Under the bushes, under the rocks, under the trees, up trees, everywhere. No cat. After 20 minutes of frantic searching, my heart was pounding. I was ready to really panic. Then, like she always did, she appeared from under some bush I swear I had already looked in. Miraculous, chipper, and happy, she strode out with a look that said, "Hey, Dave, where you been all night? Beautiful day, isn't it?" And then she asked for food. In Nevada City, a sleepy hippie town in the foothills of the Sierra, we stayed with Sherry Snook. Sherry Snook is what I call my California big sister. She's the crazy grab life by the lapels and shake big sister I always wanted. Over the years, one of my life's greatest joys is being the crazy uncle that breezes into town and makes you laugh to Sherry's two little daughters. After a week's stay and a few gigs, Nickel and I motored on to the east, to Reno, Nevada, and points beyond. We played the nickel slots and splashed in the beautiful water park the city of Reno has sculpted right downtown, making the Truckee River into a fun series of swimming holes and small rapids. We steamed east on Highway 50, the loneliest highway in America, it says on the road map, and so it seems, as the mountain ranges and broad deserts valleys set themselves up, row on row, mile after mile, one after another. We stopped at Spencer Hot Springs, just east of the dried-up silver mining town of Austin, Nevada. It was there I took off the necklace that I'd painstakingly made for Rochelle, a symbol of our love. There, on a fence post, I hung the half-black, half-white rock, almost like a natural yin-yang, the rock I found on the ruddy beaches of Nome, Alaska. It was on those same beaches where prospectors were able to eke out a living, separating the gold from the coarse sand under the 23-hour-a-day sun of Nome, Alaska, in the summer of 1900. It was there that I left the necklace, while Nickel and I took a long soak in the therapeutic mineral waters that spring forth from the desert. It was there that I left the necklace. I didn't realize until days later, far too late, to go back. It probably wouldn't be there by then anyway. There it was, the very symbol of love between Rochelle and I, left swinging in the wind in one of the most beautiful and sacred places I know. Nickel and I drove on. After the hot springs, we took a long cut, like a shortcut, but different, down dozens of miles of dirt roads to reconnect with the loneliest highway in America, from what must be the loneliest dirt roads in America. At one intersection, the road seemed to turn into the driveway of a picturesquely run-down farmhouse, miles and miles from any others. Out here, it's easy to realize that, other than the wide-eyed, enjoying-the-ride Nickel, there were no other humans for dozens of miles. I don't know if anyone was in the farmhouse. Three dirt roads diverged in the desert, outside its gates. It didn't match what was on the map. I thought of knocking on the door to ask directions. I pictured a real-life version of the old joke, me. We're a bit lost. Do you know where this road goes? Dust-hardened rancher. Well, I've been here 30 years, and I ain't seen that road go nowhere. After some creative deductions, I figured out we should head to the north and turn Vincent onto a long gravel slope of a road and settled in for more miles. About half an hour later, out of the monotone rhythm of the passing sagebrush, dark spots appeared. Mustangs. I rolled to a stop. I'd seen wild mustangs before, but Nichols certainly hadn't. I put the telephoto lens on my classic Pentax K1000, a camera as simple and reliable as an old VW, and began focusing for a picture. Now at this point, I need to digress and talk about Nichols' shoes. She insisted on wearing this pair of leather flats that were so worn out they no longer qualified as shoes. They didn't even qualify as bedroom slippers. The balls of her feet burned through the gaping holes in the sole when we walked on Reno's hot pavement, and prickers mercilessly jabbed into her feet through the torn seams on the sides of the shoes. A boy she'd met, I think from Italy, gave her the shoes. At one point in the geologic record, they were a fine pair of footwear, but now they were the rotting corpses of fine Italian fashion. They were sentimental, and I understood that, and mostly laughed it off as part of Nickel's charms. But now she was running off into the desert in those flimsy old things. She'd blurted out something about wanting to run with the wild horses, and she did. She ran towards them, spooked them into a gallop, and then took a parallel course. I kept releasing the shutter on my camera, Nickel bounding through the sagebrush, horses bounding in the background, Nickel having a beautiful, spontaneous, transformative moment, and the Mustangs wondering what was up with this psycho chick. A part of me winced the whole time as she was running. This was rattlesnake and scorpion country, and her, bounding in blind ecstasy with nothing but the mummified remains of Italian shoes on her feet to protect her, I was worried. As she caught her breath back at the bus, I chastised her for her carelessness. So far from anywhere, no cell phone. Miles from even from the highway. Rattlesnakes and scorpions, oh my, I told her. Ever since that moment, I regretted bursting that bubble. And now, 5 years later, I learned I need not regret. With a smile, she recounted the story, and rattlesnakes and scorpions, oh my, only added to the mystique. The luck we didn't have playing nickel slots, apparently we did have, out in the sagebrush that day. The next morning, I remember waking up missing Rochelle, a strange juxtaposition, with Nickel breathing next to me. Still, we went through the morning routine. At around noon, we rolled into the Duck Valley Indian Reservation, a square of third-world sagebrush straddling the Idaho-Nevada border. Evening found us bucking a severe headwind out of Cary, Idaho. In most cars, the idea of worrying about a headwind is a cute flight of nostalgia, or a partially funny airplane or sailboat metaphor. But in Vincent, the microbus, it can mean the difference between 55 miles an hour on that ever-so-slight incline, or crawling up at 30 miles an hour. It's good to keep in mind that there are Harley Davidsons with bigger motors than Vincent. We forged ahead at both speeds, me trying for fourth gear when I could. Eventually, we made it to the long, narrow gravel pull-off with a 100-yard trail to a beautiful natural hot pool nestled in the grass and sage of central Idaho. After a long nighttime soak, I got the maps out in the bus. Tomorrow, I played in Bozeman, Montana. After adding the little mileage numbers next to the highways on the map, I realized I'd have to get up at 6 a.m. to make it. 6 a.m. is never easy for a musician, but the morning was beautiful. And Nickel stayed in bed, I had the hot springs to myself. After a soak, I made coffee and two egg sandwiches. I ate one while driving and left the other under a plate for Nicole when she got up. Past Craters of the Moon National Monument, Nicole slept. Past the eerie compounds of the U.S. Department of Energy's sprawling National Laboratory, Nicole slept. At Rexburg, I poked my way down Main Street, trying to guess which street would turn into the unnamed two-lane road that ran alongside the four-lane interstate, heading for Montana. Then, there were flashing lights in my rearview mirror. Unworried, as I was doing nothing wrong, I pulled to the side of the road. The cop was young and businesslike. The reason I pulled you over is we got a call from someone reporting you were driving erratically. I suppose I might have been, officer, as I've never been to this town before, and I think I might have missed my turn. I was trying to head north, and have you been drinking this morning? No, I haven't. Take off your sunglasses. It was about noon, and my eyes squinted and blinked. You aren't on any drugs, are you? Officer, you know I wouldn't be doing that, I said. I don't know you, he said, and peered in the window towards the back of the bus. Nicole had gotten up about half an hour before. You see, throughout the trip, I'd been amazed at her ability to find a different and flamboyantly fashionable outfit for every day of the trip. Today, with the bed still out, she must have been taking inventory. Like a Joanne Fabrics had imploded in the back of the bus, cloths of all different colors and patterns were strewn about everywhere imaginable. Nicole was in the middle of the melee, with yet another unseen by me, or the officer, bombastically fashionable outfit. She'd probably smiled at him. The white cat was somewhere surfing the fashion, and it may have taken the poor officer's brain a few extra nanoseconds to comprehend that among the collage of colored cloth, the white cat with blue eyes wasn't just a stuffed animal accessory. At any rate, his eyes grew wide behind his aviator glasses, and his questioning slipped into neutral for a moment. Then back at it, he asked me the same questions I'd answered at the Canadian-American border countless times. Do you have any weapons in the vehicle? No. I answered the same way I always did at the Canadian-American borders. Do you have any alcohol in the vehicle? Yes, I have a few beers in the cooler, and there's a half a bottle of whiskey in the cupboard in the back. Any illegal drugs? No. Can I see the whiskey? That was a new question. But sure, I said. He stepped back, I got out of the door, around, opened the side door, and reached my arm deep inside the food cupboard, and retrieved a bottle of Canadian whiskey, with actually only about a quarter of it missing. I bought it in Whitehorse, Yukon Territory, about 4 weeks ago, and I guess about a quarter of it was all I'd managed to drink during those 4 weeks. He took the bottle in his hand. You know, this is an open container, don't you? Was he really going there, I thought? Was he really going to confiscate my bottle of whiskey? After all, it was tucked far into a cupboard in the back of the bus. It's clearly an open container, he explained, and I can arrest you for that right now. With all due respect, officer, I backpedaled. I've spoken to another law enforcement officer about this very problem. As you can see, this is a vehicle that has no separate trunk. And since I'm not going to consume a whole bottle of whiskey in one night, I have to put it somewhere. And that officer that I spoke with said the best I could do was to tuck it in a cupboard in the back of the bus. I've crossed the border into America and into Canada many times without a problem, and I'm just trying to do exactly as I've been told to do, to be within the law as best as possible with this vehicle. Who was this officer you spoke to, and where was he from? He questioned. I don't remember exactly, I said. What the officer had really told me was that I should keep any unused alcohol in a cupboard closet in the back, and any cop that pulled me over would have to be a real asshole to write me up for it. Apparently, I just met a real asshole, as he explained how he wasn't going to arrest me, but I'd have to appear in court to face the charges next week. I explained how by next week I was supposed to be up in Canada, and how I played music, how I was traveling, how I had a contract to fulfill that very night in Bozeman. And when I got back up to Alaska, I had a full-time job waiting for me. To delay a week would jeopardize all of that. He considered, thought for a moment. He said, you know, we have a canine in it with another officer in the area. Do you mind if our dog sniffs your bus? That would be fine, I said. About 5 minutes later, the other car rolled up. The dog looked happy enough. The white cat freaked out, of course, and we put her on her leash, and Nicole tried to console her in the shade of a nearby bush. The officer that brought the dog was older, probably in his early 50s. And leading with the leash, he let the dog climb into the fabric menagerie in the back of the bus. The dog immediately, of course, honed in on the egg sandwich still waiting for Nickel under the plate. The officer yanked him back from there, around the bus, sniffing, in and about, back of the bus, front of the bus. About 3 minutes, it was all over. The dog was done, and, of course, nothing was found. Squeezy was more at ease, and I explained again my unique situation to both officers this time, mentioning that maybe this would be a good time to use your discretion to fit the situation. They conferred privately for a minute, and the younger came back to me. "Well," he said, "I've never done this before, but I'm just going to let you two go with a warning." I bet he hadn't ever done that before. I was still pissed he was going to keep my whiskey. It was good stuff and unavailable in the States, and it was still 3/4 full. But I was relieved that a more mature voice of reason had showed up with his dog to see that justice was served, not just laws enforced. Driving away, I wondered if there really was ever a phone call made about an erratically driving VW bus. Was there a quota in this town? Was it the end of the month or something? Or maybe the young officer saw this as his last best chance to bust real hippies in a real hippie van. But what I did find out days later made me extra grateful for the kind gesture of an extra egg sandwich I made for Nickel. A couple weeks later, we were making progress north on the Icefields Parkway, the amazingly scenic road that bisects lengthwise Banff and then Jasper National Parks in Canada. I still don't know why, but it was at a roadside pull-off where we stopped for lunch. She showed me the little plastic container, the kind that 35mm film comes in. The little plastic container tucked in the bag with her menagerie of outfits. The little plastic container half full of pot. It was enough to last her over a month, she smiled. A friend of a friend had given it to her back in Nevada City, California. "So this was in here when the cops stopped us in Idaho?" I questioned, already knowing the answer. "You need to get rid of this," I commanded. "British Columbia's liberal pot laws be damned. Or at least you need to tell me you got rid of this." "I'm not going to lie to you," she declared self-righteously. We were silent for a moment. I wasn't backing down. By this point in the trip, this wasn't our first fight. We were an odd couple, to say the least. Her from a shattered home, a childhood riddled with the heartbreak of family letting her down. She was on her own by 15, or at least when she was on her own, things went a lot better. She'd never left Canada before, scarcely ever left British Columbia. Me, my parents helped me all the way through college and after, middle-class, suburban home. I just had my heart shattered about a month before by a beautiful, but also tragic girl. Nickel and I fought, disagreed more, or more she would get depressed, morose, and I would fail no matter how I tried to make things better for her. But these episodes were the exception, and they're to be expected on a long journey, two people cramped in a small bus. We were both sad the last night we spent together in her apartment there in Prince George. We made love, passionately, physically, emotionally, the kind that makes you want to cry afterward. We'd been through so much together, such a grand adventure. The next morning, I drove off alone on a sunny August day. 100 kilometers from Prince George, Arlo Guthrie sang Riding on the City of New Orleans over the FM radio. The sons of Pullman porters and the sons of engineers ride their father's magic carpet made of steel. Indeed, magic carpets made of steel. I sent her pictures in the mail, one framed, and a letter a few months later. Rochelle and I had got back together when I got back up to Anchorage, and that winter she broke my heart again. In the spring, we gave it one more try. We decided to give it one more try by moving to Reno, Nevada. I loved the swimming in the river there, and I loved the trashy glitz of the casinos. Rochelle was accepted at the University of Nevada, Reno. I'd try playing music full-time, and life would go on. On the drive from Alaska down to Reno, Rochelle forbid me to see Nickel. I tried anyway, but she wasn't in town when we passed through Prince George. Rochelle never forgave me for trying, though, and she never understood why I would want to see Nickel again. The phone calls had dropped off long before. Then the email soon stopped. That was the end of the story. And for this week's show, that is the end of the story. You've been listening to the My Home is on the Road show. My name is Dave Manning. For more about me or my music, go to davemanning.net. Next week, we will finish the story, find out how Nickel and I found each other again 5 years later.